the property owner's right of due process and the ownership and enjoying any rights to his land. For example, if we were to say that the Scenic Rivers Bill took in the whole watershed as represented on this map that was given to you previously, I think you could see that if this was in private ownership, that you would be usurping an awful lot of property, which I don't think the state could control without paying proper money to control that land as a state. The reason for wilderness areas is not to impose more restrictive controls on land, it's more or less to maintain the status quo, and I think that is something that is often overlooked. By maintaining the status quo, you do put up barriers or restrictions that people often refer to them as to prohibit the entrance into this area by certain types of activities. I feel that the problem in the state is that we're running into, I suppose 8 or 10 years ago, you couldn't have talked about wilderness before the state legislature. You'd probably been laughed out of any hearing room, but I think in the last few years we've seen a definite shift in the attitude of the population of this state leaning towards wilderness. And I believe that the reason for this is that more and more people are getting out here in the Cascades and along the Coast Range, and they're seeing some of the more or less poor responsible acts of management that have been imposed by economic interests in the taking of timber from these hills. Nobody's arguing that timber isn't a strong element of our economy, but what they do argue is that the timber industry certainly doesn't need every standing tree in the state just because it has some sort of, quote, economic value, end quote. A compromise, I feel, could be achieved between the timber industries in this state and the interest groups such as the one I represent, the Sierra Club, by achieving a responsible board or commission to look at many of our beautiful areas in this state and try and come at some equitable compromise in the preservation of these areas. I don't believe this is going to be achieved as long as the timber interests continue to squawk and scream every time somebody tries to add a little bit more land to raise the 1% wilderness area in the state some meaningful or insignificant amount. I think that a commission that, if it were set up, would have to represent equally both sides of the interest. In other words, it couldn't be one of these commissions that are set up they load the board up with interest representing just one side, and then they put on maybe a couple of environmentalists to appease the population, and then they can vote through anything they want. And I think if you have reasonable parties involved representing both sides in a reasonable manner, then possibly through some long-term studies we could take a look at some of the solutions that appear to be cropping up in this state. Second problem that we are up against is I personally do not like to have to deal with Washington, D.C. on problems that relate to the state of Oregon. For example, the preservation of the Oregon Cascades and something that is a meaningful unit of management rather than spot of wilderness here and a spot of wilderness there, or as you fly over the area, observe that nearly the entire range has been clear-cut in patches from the Nahood or from the Columbia River all the way south to the California border. I think it's going to take a lot of work on behalf of the states to encourage Congress at the national level to allow some of the controls to come back to the states where it belongs, and where state legislatures can respond more effectively to the interests of the population as a whole. I find it somewhat frustrating to have to deal with Washington, where you talk about the problem of people over in eastern Oregon not wanting the people on the coast telling them what to do in their problem. But I find that I can get more response out of senators, U.S. senators and congressmen from the states of Maryland, Minnesota, and New York State on these issues than I can on sometimes our own representatives on issues like matter. So I just throw these out as some suggestions because I think you were trying to achieve them. I'd also like to sponsor more wilderness areas and set these areas aside. And then in the future, when we get into balloon logging or helicopter logging or what have you, then we can take another look at it and possibly then enter into these areas. But I think it's up to industry to prove first that they can enter these areas and do their economic thing in there without destroying the ecology. Because I don't think it's right that the people of the state of Oregon should have to prove to industry that they are ruining these areas. I think there's enough examples throughout the Oregon Cascades to indicate that there is damage being done and will continue to be done until we look at this in a more reasonable manner. I'll answer any questions anybody may have.
Questions? I'd like to thank you for that last statement. That's what I was looking for a while ago. I think you said that if this was all private territory, that we couldn't do anything about it. Why was that?
No, I was stating that I wasn't referring specifically to that area. What I was referring to is the Scenic Rivers Act as it pertains to land that is adjacent to a river that's under that system, which is under private ownership. The bill will protect the area within a quarter of a mile of that. But if it goes much beyond that, I think it would be interfering with due process, so that person's right to exercise what he wants on that overall parcel of ground. For example, if it were
But you're not saying we couldn't pass legislation to do that.
No, I'm not saying you couldn't pass legislation to do that.
That's what zoning laws are in effect.
To a certain degree, yes.
Well, that's what the beach bill is, the zoning law.
Right, but if you're talking about timber interest, let's say Boise Cascade being a private entity owns a strip of land that's up a canyon wall that may be a mile to the top. Scenic Rivers could control the first quarter mile of that, surely, by preventing logging. But if you were to tell that industry that they couldn't log the rest of that hill, I think you would be interfering with the property rights of ownership of that timber.
You mean under the present law?
Under the present law, and I certainly suggest that even under future laws, it would be questionable.
Well, I wonder about that. You know, we've told people on the coast they can't build on land they own.
Yes, but it's only within a reasonable distance and in land that's always been in question in the first place.
I just wonder on your statement, you'd like to see things getting back to the state. Do you think for a minute that if Oregon state legislature had complete control over the state of Oregon, that we would have the land today, the wilderness and forest areas that we have now?
I think in some cases, I don't think that it would have changed too much. I think you'd have the same types of pressures that created those areas in the first place, because the wilderness areas that have been created in the state of Oregon have been the result of work done by Oregonians. So I would say that regardless of the legislative control that you have, whether it be federal or state, that you would probably still have what you
have today. It took us 15 years to get the Wild River bill through the legislature and out to the vote of the people. Unless we have, if we get into a factual fight,
we get it through. It was an initiative.
Well, it was an initiative, but I mean, we to get it voted. I civil rights, if we left up to the states, we wouldn't have any civil rights. I think this idea that the federal government is a big bugaboo and we don't get these things for the people unless this is what happens. The legislatures will not pass them, and then the people go to Congress and they get them passed. On some things we want them to do it. On others, we don't. It just depends on who wants to do it. Are there more people who support it? Federal government and civil rights.
I don't believe you understood my comment. I was saying that I think that much of the control of our lands within the state of Oregon should belong to the state legislature rather than Congress, U.S. Congress.
I've got a nice thought, but it wouldn't get too involved. The people up in the mountains that are talking about the economy get down on their shoulders, saving the Oregon Beach. If it didn't get up to those people down on Oregon Beach, that would never been saved.
Yeah, but it passed.
No, it would have passed.
Well, it passed, though. What's your argument? I'm trying to shoot a hole on it. The people on the coast of Jet
didn't pass. But we had a devil in that
pass. Oh, you're just inconsistent. Further questions for Mr. Stubbs? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Herbert Anderson.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Herbert Anderson. I'm a partner in the law firm of McCulloch, Desendarc, Sears, and Liberski in Portland, Oregon. I'm appearing here on behalf of the Friends of the Miners. This legislation, which is now pending in Congress, we consider necessary for the following reasons. First, there is a shortage of wilderness. The wilderness areas are presently being overused, and the projected population figures indicate that this problem will increase. There is, of course, a conflict between economic development and the need to preserve a high-quality environment. But in regard to Mr. McPherson's question about percentages, we're talking about a very small percentage. There is no argument and no conflict over about 98% of the surface of the earth. It is devoted to economic development without any argument. We're talking mainly about the 2%, which is preserved for recreational or aesthetic purposes, or which it is desired to preserve. The state of Oregon has between 1% and 2% preserved as wilderness areas. Surrounding states all have more, varying from 2% to 5%. The amount that we're talking about here is a fraction of 1%. It's a very small area. The Minum River is unique and irreplaceable. Minum River is the last of its kind, a crystal clear stream which from its source in the Malala Mountains for 50 miles to its confluence with the Walla River is uncontaminated by man-made erosion. The unique feature of this river is its remarkably pure and clear water. The transparency of its waters emits light in such abundance that its polished boulders and gravel sparkle in incomparable brilliance. The aesthetic and artistic qualities of the river outweigh the other attributes, but other features are nonetheless substantial. The Minum is a great spawning ground for steelhead and salmon. Steelhead, which enter the Columbia in the summer months, reach the Minum and its tributaries in the following May. Many Chinook and some Coho arrive and spawn in the summer and early fall. Formerly, 29% of the salmon which passed McNary Dam spawned in the Snake River system above Hell's Canyon Dam. Now no fish pass Hell's Canyon Dam. This gives greater importance to the remaining spawning areas in the lower rivers, such as the Minum. To provide the proper volume and rate of oxygen exchange, spawning gravels must remain porous. Studies indicate that a slight increase in suspended particulates in the water and consequently lower gravel permeability causes a sharp drop in survival of eggs to fry. A great increase in siltation destroys spawning in an entire section of the river. This canyon is now the only winter habitat in that area for elk. The Game Commission advises, that should be a correction in the statement, the Game Commission advises that roads in the area will haze the elk out of their one remaining refuge and cause substantial loss. Actually, a road up to Minum is not feasible. Just above the forest boundary, vertical rock walls drop into the Minum River, and the a road up the Minum River from the forest boundary would require substantial blasting, full bench construction, and the expense would be tremendous. I think the Forest Service realizes this because since 1963 it has not suggested a road up the Minum River. A road down the Minum River, down the Little Minum, which was suggested by the Forest Service in 1963, would result in tremendous erosion. The Little Minum Canyon consists of steep mountain slopes of basalt overlaid with a morainal material which is lightly veneered to the underlying rock. Soil mantle on these slopes is at the natural angle of repose. Geologists report that the area is naturally unstable. Any disturbance by man's activities will result in erosion, which will damage or destroy the spawning grouse. Any cutting into the toe slopes of these canyons may result in slides of catastrophic proportions. That is exactly what happened in Looking Glass Canyon, about 30 miles from the Minum. There, a road was built by the Forest Service 3 years ago, and a slide resulted where a mountain literally slid into the river, destroying the spawning bed for a considerable period to come. The best way to protect the Minum and preserve its status quo is to record it wilderness state. The beauty of the Lower Minum is partly in its gentle character and the ease with which people, especially families with children, can hike through the valley. There are numerous flats and park-like areas. The climate is superior to the high lakes and accessible during the spring and early summer when the higher regions are blocked by snow drifts and flooding streams. The lower river has more exciting fishing with the possibility of larger fish not present in the higher areas. The Lower Minum has an attraction different from the mountains of the Eagle Cap. It is a river valley protected by the from the mountain storms. It is a peaceful and remote area of great natural beauty, which can be reached without the arduous climb necessary to get into the mountain areas of the Eagle Cap. It would make wilderness available to some who may not be able to go into the mountains. Here one can drive to the forest boundary, get out of the car, and easily walk up the gradual river trail. This legislation will not have any adverse economic effects on the area. In particular, it will not affect the allowable cut in the Wallowa-Whitman Forest. For many years, the Minum timber has not been available for timber utilization due to the moratorium status which the Forest Service has maintained as a result of the public outcry against its proposals in 1961 and 1963 to build roads into the Minum and commence logging. Under the new timber management plan of the Forest Service, the new allowable cut figures will not include the Minum River drainage timber. This means that the allowable cut will not be affected by this legislation since the Minum timber is no longer a part of the basis for calculating the allowable cut. This legislation has the support of the Oregon Game Commission, which has indicated that the winter habitat of the Wallowa elk herd would be endangered by the roads in the area and that the spawning grounds for salmon and steelhead would be damaged by construction in the area. Citizens of Oregon support this legislation by a large majority. When the public hearing was held by the Senate Committee in La Grande last summer, about 500 people appeared and enthusiastically supported this legislation. This legislature will be reflecting the desires of the citizens of Oregon by passing this tomorrow. I'd like to give you, Mr. Chairman, a copy of the report that was filed by the Game Commission with the Senate Committee at a hearing in Washington. Maybe I should keep going.
Mm-hmm.
would like to make some additional comments in regard to some of the other statements. I would like to say to the members of the committee, particularly to Representative Martin, that I'm in no way critical of his understanding of legislation, because as a lawyer, I very much appreciate that I don't know all the laws. Frequently, Layman will ask me what a particular law is. Of course, I can't keep all the state and federal laws in mind, and I fully appreciate it, but you legislators don't have on the tip of your tongue the provisions of the many hundreds of bills that are introduced each session. But I do want to say about, so what I say is not in any criticism of any comments that may have been made by any legislators here, although it does differ from some of the statements. In regard to the Scenic Rivers bill, Senator Wilner testified at the hearing in Graham that that bill was not adequate to preserve the minor. And in particular, that bill, as Representative Mann testified, applies only to 1/4 mile on each side of the river. And it doesn't apply at all to federal lands. It was cited in the Pelton Dam case by the United States Supreme Court that the state of Oregon could not in any way zone or affect federal lands, and the Scenic Rivers Bill doesn't attempt to control the activities of the federal government in the federal forest. This is what Senator Wilner did say about the effect of the Scenic Rivers Bill. He said, "The Martin River is 45 miles long. First 15 miles are now in the Eagle Cap Wilderness area. The next 22 miles are in the Malala Whitman National Forest and would be changed to wilderness by the bill that you are now considering. And the lower 8 miles are in private ownership. The Oregon Scenic Rivers Initiative would provide protection for these lower 8 miles. If our initiative measure passes in November and the rivers in the state scenic river system are administratively included under the Federal Wild Rivers Act, as called for by that federal act, and as recently was carried out in connection with the Allegash River in Maine, then the canyon will be protected only for 1/2 mile in width." So the Scenic River still, admirable as it is, has definite limitations and doesn't afford, in my opinion, adequate protection for this area. Now, regarding to the Wilderness Act, there are also some misconceptions about the effect of the Wilderness Act. Senator Raymond testified that he feared that grazing would be protected, but Section 4D6 of the Wilderness Act provides that grazing, where previously allowed, shall continue to be allowed in the wilderness area. And this very area that we're talking about is presently pastured both by cattle and sheep. As a matter of fact, the band of sheep last year pretty well ate up all the pasture up there. Pretty much pasture for a year or two or more because they overgrazed. Someone mentioned about timber diseases, and Danny Power correctly pointed out that the Wilderness Act permits access to wilderness areas to remove diseased trees in Section 4D1, and even build roads in for that purpose. Then McPherson asked some figures about the timber, and I can't give you all the figures that you asked for, although I'll be glad to supply them by a letter, but I can say that I can correct one statement. A figure was mentioned in Washington, D.C. of some 800 million board feet as being involved in this area. That was based upon not the area now involved, but a larger area. Originally, this bill was drawn with 6 townships involved. And it was provided that the Secretary of Agriculture should select that portion of the area needed to protect the Mine River Canyon from those 6 townships. Now the bill has been revised and the boundaries have been particularized in the bill. And they don't include anywhere near the 6 townships. include only 80,000 acres. And John Rogers, the forest supervisor for the Lyell Whitman Forest, says that the estimated timber in the Minum River drainage is 450 million board feet. He also advises that the passage of this bill will not affect the allowable cut because it is not now in the basis for the allowable cut. So passage of this bill have no effect at all on the allowable cut in the area. Of course, they weren't cutting any timber anyway, as everyone understands. And as I understand it, no one is urging that any of this timber actually be cut. They were simply suggesting that it would be a part of the basis and allow a greater portion of the timber in other parts of the forest to be cut. I want to mention that this bill is not any kind of a limitation or change, but would simply preserve the status quo. This area is, and always has been, a de facto wilderness area, and this bill would not change that, but would maintain the status quo. So this is not a change in the present situation. If I understood Mr. Prinsall, Western Wood Products, correctly, he indicated that 50% of the forest area in the state of Oregon is now unroaded. Senator McPherson asked if there wasn't some middle ground as to where we could arrive at in setting aside areas. Well, I think there must be some middle ground, and there has to be some place where the legislatures are going to draw the line, but it doesn't seem to me that it's unreasonable to draw that line down around the 1-2% area, and that's all we're talking about. We're not trying to preserve even half of that 50%, which is now unroaded, but only a very, very small portion of it. On the map, some reference was made to inholdings. There are only two inholdings left, actually. That's the Larise Minum River Lodge and Red Horse Ranch. The other portions, which are shown in red on the map that you have, are presently being traded by the Forest Service for other land. They belong to Boise Cascade, and they have a section in one place and another parcel in another place. But those are being acquired by the Forest Service by trade. That's all I have to say, Jim.
Question for Mr. Anderson.
Chairman. I don't understand all your statements that this is a de facto wilderness area. If it is, why the memorial? Why Hatfield, Bill, and Dennis? Why is Mr. Ullman coming up with some new ideas if it's already there? What are we doing with our time?
Well, we're now in the 10th year of this debate. The Forest Service originally wanted to put a road up the mine and clear to the mouth of the North Mine. There was a great deal of opposition to that. Then they proposed a road down the Little Mine. Then, in 1964, while that matter was still under consideration, the Wilderness Act was passed, and they became engaged in the study of primitive areas for their suitability for wilderness, and they stopped temporarily studies on the mine. We tried to get them to resume as soon as they finished their studies of primitive areas in this Region 6, but they wouldn't resume the studies of the Minum. And in conferences which I and others had with Herbert Stone, who was then the regional forester, he indicated it was still his desire to see roads put into this area. And somebody asked, was it possible to, could we say definitely that there would be no way to log this area? Well, nobody could say that because that's a theoretical.
Anderson, your general statement that you opened on that subject was that this memorial really didn't assist or cease it. It wasn't going to change the situation. And then, at least to me, you alluded that this was a wilderness area. So I'm asking, why is all this action going on?
The action is going on to preserve it. To preserve it from the possibility of roads or construction or activities which will create erosion, because the Forest Service has indicated that it still hasn't given up on the possibility of putting roads into this area. And that is the reason for this legislation, is because the Forest Service hasn't acted to place this area, to add this area to the wilderness preservation system. It is the same reason that has compelled the desire for legislation in regard to wilderness areas elsewhere. In Idaho, Montana, and California have recently added large wilderness areas by congressional action. And I might say, in regard to the federal government's actions on this, really, the only place we can go to get action on the federal forest is to the federal government. The state doesn't control the federal forest, and Congress, by passing the Wilderness Act of 1964, has actually preempted the policy-making power in this regard and removed that prerogative even from the Department of Agriculture, which formerly exercised it by administrative decision. And it has created wilderness areas by administrative decision since about 1920 or thereabouts, give or take a year or two. And the National Park Service since about 1916 has been creating wilderness areas by administrative decision. But the Diary of the Wilderness Act, I take it that Congress has now determined that that decision as to the creation of wilderness areas shall be made by Congress. And I take it from talking to Forest Service people that that is their interpretation also.
You make some statements in here. Any disturbance will result in erosion, damaging, or destroying. A road down the Little Minot would result. You don't say may, potentially. You say will and would. Is this?
Well, Representative, I guess.
An opinion, a statement, or are there engineering studies? Is this your opinion, or is this something on paper?
No, there are geologic reports. I'd be glad to get one for you, and I'll get that and send that to you. This area is
your engineering report, not
geology report.
How about design engineer?
As far as I know, they've never gone
through. Then we ought to leave alone.
Have never gone so far as to get a design engineer because they've never gotten that to the extent of actually designing a road.
I didn't know if you might have taken the job as some of the Fed survey.
I took this out of a report from made by the Forest Service. The situation is that this these are very steep slopes that are overlaid by a light soil mantle, and even with the trails that they have now, just the foot and horse trails, there is considerable erosion in places just resulting from those trails alone. When they build a road in Looking Glass Canyon, north of Elgin, about 3 years ago, the side of the mountain just slid right into Looking Glass Creek. These are very unstable areas, and I don't think there's any doubt that we would have tremendous erosion when they logged on the Minum, on the tributary of the Minum known as Squaw Creek. The Minum was discolored and murky for months and months afterwards. It, I think, is impossible to have any kind of logging in activity in this area and preserve the transparent quality of the water of the Minum River, which is the unique thing in this area. This is the only entire river which we have, which is of this sparkling, clear quality, which is left presently unroded. And I will furnish you, sir, that geologist report.
May I ask you on what you base your statement that the large majority of the citizens of Oregon support this? We're having trouble with what's going on in Union and Wallowa County on their polls.
Well, I think the poll made by the paper was by the Grand Observer was not slain of either way. It just asked them to indicate their opinion one way or the other. It's true that the paper at the same time was carrying on an editorial campaign in favor of this proposal, and if that may have influenced some of the votes, but my own experience in visiting Union County, and I do so quite often, is that the opinion in Union County is extremely heavy in favor of this proposal. If it's not 7-1, it certainly is a very, very substantial majority. The colleagues at LeGrand took a poll of the Chamber of Commerce, whose board of directors had opposed this, and found that the majority of the Chamber of Commerce were in favor of this proposal. Now, there is a situation over in Wallowa County, which is different. Over there, as you probably all know, they were very disappointed that there were no dams to be built in the Snake River, where Enterprise Joseph would have been the gateways to those areas and would have had a considerable economic impact as jump-off points for that construction. And my own opinion, I've heard it voiced by others up there, is that the Minum is suffering from the action taken on those Snake River dams, that it's a backlash, that they're against all conservationists to some extent as a result of that disappointment on the Snake River dams.
Your statement relates to the citizens of Oregon, not those two candidates.
Well, Union and Baker, I'm quite sure, are very heavily in favor. Wallowa is about evenly divided.
How do you arrive at the citizens of Oregon support this legislation by a large majority?
Well, I arrive at
1,091,000 people.
I arrive
saying that over 1 million would support this.
I arrive at it by my conclusion based on the vote on the Scenic River Bill, by the poll taken by the LeGrand Observer, by just talking to people in Baker, Union, and Wallowa County, by talking to people in Western Oregon, by the statements of the newspapers. I have seen, dozens, maybe scores of editorials by newspapers throughout the state of Oregon supporting this legislation. I've yet to see an editorial which opposes it. If there is a body of sentiment opposed to this, other than that which is engendered by Boise Cascade and by some small groups who are not large groups representing vehicle groups, I haven't heard, and I have talked to a lot of people, and I have not come across any substantial opposition. There is opposition, but number-wise, I think my statement is easily correct. I do know that Senator Hatfield has had a tremendous outpouring of letters and contacts with him which favor this legislation by a tremendous majority. Those are the things I base it on. It's nothing scientific, but it's all I have to go on.
Thank you. like to ask you one more question. This is perhaps a theoretical question. Maybe you can give me a call later. The figure 1% roughly of our forest lands in Oregon are in wilderness. Like somebody said, the rest of Western states is like 2%.
I think California has 5%.
Okay, what's the ratio of California's population to their wilderness, Oregon to their wilderness area? And should we begin to look at whatever the population estimates are and begin to look at the state as how much area in theory should be retained and develop an overall plan rather than fighting brush fires?
Well, I think that would be tremendous if the legislature would undertake that, but as Representative Martin indicated, if you had, you couldn't even get the Scenic River Belt through the legislature, and that would be done by an initiative measure. But I do want to say that I'm tremendously impressed by the attention that this committee is giving to this matter, and
we could attach population control to it. I think we could make it work.
Mr. Anderson, I don't want you to mistake my opinions in this. I very definitely, though I live in the metropolitan area of Fulton, would like to see the Minor River area preserved and in no way any of the damage that you've described done to it. I think I would take that, and I think we ought to realize, though, that the damage is probably being done by you and me and not by the people that Ed Patterson represented. Population between 1960 and 1970 in eastern Oregon, all the areas east of Cascade, dropped by 500 people. And the damage is being done probably by people going in and the people from the urban areas, not the people from out from hit there. And I am also concerned that we're pending, as we have done for 40 years in this country, also that Washington is a savior. They've been trying to solve our social ills for 40 years, and it seems to me they haven't done a very damn good job. I'm on the National Advisory Board of Sports, Fishery, and Wildlife, and I sat with the new Secretary of Interior, Rogers Morton, for a day and a half last December, and we talked about wilderness areas. And they're having a hell of a time trying to manage them. And they frankly admit they're not doing a very good job of it. And it just distresses me that all we have to do is tell Senator Hatfield, do it, baby, and it'll be solved. Because I don't think it's going to happen that way. And if we really want to solve our problems, I'd like to see them solved in Oregon. And if that Scenic Rivers Bill was passed, doesn't do the job, then by God, let's get a change. But I just don't see the savior in Washington, D.C. Now, I'm sure it'll satisfy a lot of people here if we pass this resolution or this memorial, and I think you ought to understand, we've passed hundreds of memorials and mailed them to Washington, they go right in the waste paper basket. I don't think they've made a damn.
Chairman, I disagree with that.
Wonderful.
I disagree with the theory that they go in the waste paper basket. I've been back here and had congressmen from that Alabama show me resolutions that were passed by the Oregon State Legislature. Now, they don't just go in the waste paper basket, and they're read by Congress. I listen to this every day and by people. And I do think that some people in Washington are trying to do a job for the state that they come from. I resent
the point is that I think we'll have a lot better,
about
a lot better effect trying to get the job solved here. I don't see this savior in the wilderness area because they've had a hell of a time of industry in another state. And the record is to go into an area like this, there are bridges. I walked out down to mine, man-made bridges. The Department of Interior in enforcing their wilderness areas have a flat rule they take down any man-made structure of any kind. This would wipe out those bridges on the trail going up the mine. It's the things they do, they patent, they admit are ridiculous, but that's the regulations they follow.
Well, I don't like to disagree with you too much, Representative, but it's the Department of Agriculture which is administering the forest, not the Department of Interior, and they don't take down bridges. In fact, last summer when I was up there, they just built a new road up to Green Lake and put in a couple of bridges in there. I do agree with you to this extent, that I think Forest Service is overly restrictive in administering the wilderness areas. They're taking the attitude, well, as far as I know, Forest Service is not against bridges, and the Department of Interior may be, but Forest Service is building bridges over trails But they're also taking the attitude that they can't put in any kind of a development in a heavily populated area such as a prison. And to me, that's ridiculous. Of course, it detracts somewhat from the wilderness characteristic. But if you're going to have 5,000 people congregate in a particular spot in the wilderness, it just seems to me ridiculous to say we can't provide for sanitation. And I think they ought to adopt a more reasonable attitude on that. I think Marion Lakes matter is another example of where the Forest Service is unduly restricted in wilderness areas, and I agree with you on that point.
The point I brought is that there's a strong move afoot right now to move all of the Forest Service and so forth to the Department of Interior.
Yes.
And that's why I brought up the operation of the Department of Interior. I think that you and I have to be honest with each other. If we're so worried about Mr. Patterson today, maybe we better restrict the use that you and I can put on that area.
Well, you have additional areas because it's going to get worse. And I appreciate the problem that you mentioned. The wilderness is a great problem to administer, but I don't feel that because of that we should just walk away from it and say we're going to wash our hands from it and not do anything more. We're going to have to face this problem. It's going to get worse, and it presently isn't out of bounds, but it's something that we're going to have to keep on working with. It isn't going to be solved today or tomorrow. This has been 10 years, and I would be surprised if it takes a few more years longer before this matter will get resolved. But it's by hearings such as this and discussions about it that the matter is eventually resolved.
Thank you. Len Parsons.
doing anything which, if it were covered by the Act, would be violated thereof.
Well, I think I
agree with your initial reaction, but that on the other hand, there is merit in that legislation.
You're familiar with the Portland City Ordinance regarding the vagrancy, which was struck down because of vagueness.
Yeah.
All kinds of criminal statutes because of vagueness.
Right.
And so the commission shall undertake a continuing study and submit a periodic report, and they shall consider the following criteria in making such a report. Now, this is when they're going to designate a river to go into this thing, and it says the river or segment of river is relatively free flowing, and the scene as viewed from the river and adjacent land is pleasing, whether primitive or rural pastoral, or these conditions are restorable. Now, it says the river or segment of the river in its setting possesses natural and recreational values of outstanding quality. Now, that's a lot of canal water to a lot.
I agree.
And I think that's probably the worst thing that we ever foisted off on people in the name of environmental protection. And God help us, I hope we do some amendments to that thing, but that's why I think that we ought to let Congress, and I really hate to force any of our problems off on them, decided in a cool, calm deliberateness, hopefully, that takes place there, and rather than in a short 5-month session of the Oregon legislature when everything here is hell bent for election to get home. And I'm afraid we'll end up with another sort of an initiative thing like that. So I couldn't agree with you more, pardon the speech, but. For anybody who says, a lawyer who says that's the law, I worry about it.
Oh, yes. I agree with you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Mark.
Outdoors Unlimited is a national organization dedicated to equitable use of America's public lands and natural resources. Implementing the multiple use management concept is the only way to achieve this goal. We believe that public lands should be managed or used by the people. Outdoors Unlimited was originally organized in Washington in 65 by people of all walks of life, farmers, cattlemen, miners, foresters, mechanics, lawyers, and so on, who are deeply concerned about the use of public lands. They saw a need, now and in the future, for timberland management for a sustained yield basis, need for minerals and grass, a need for recreation, including areas untrammeled domains. They also saw an alarming trend being pushed into back countries by well-financed groups. They're deeply concerned over these things. My backup data here, which I will present to you, which I'll touch base on just very lightly, which I would like to have be considered as part of this statement as though it were read. First is a statement, that's a redraft of a statement I presented in Washington 1969 pertaining to this legislation. This redraft is presented to the hearing in LeGrand. The only thing I want to comment on is the last paragraph of this statement that has some of the economic benefits, got allowable cuts and so on. And going into the economic level cuts and so on, and the lack of information, and this is, I think, what we're talking about in the Minum, is the lack of information. We've got a whole different set of rules we're talking about. I don't think any of us are yet actually knowledgeable enough. I say that I strongly urge that the Senate Interior and Insular Affairs Committee table S-1142, which would enable the Forest Service to complete their necessary studies of the entire Minum drainage. These studies haven't been completed. I think if we're going to make management decisions, I think it should be backed up with facts instead of emotion. I'd like to make one comment on the next packet. There is a letter to Senator Frank Church. If you want to follow this with me, there's some backup data and so on preceding a letter from John Rogers to myself. It's a letter dated July 30, about halfway into the middle of this packet. It's page 2. I'd like to read this paragraph. I was going to omit it, Mr. Chairman, but I think for some of the testimonies presented here, I'd like to touch on just this one paragraph. Allowable cuts have been established or calculated ever since the Forest Service authorized timber cutting. In the 1950s, a policy was initiated whereby the Forest Service would update its inventory and would revise its timber management plans every 10 years. I'm sure we're all aware of this. This involves a re-inventory of existing timber and a new look at all of the factors which affect forest management and allowable cuts. The current 10-year management plan was approved for use beginning July 1, 1962. The inventory information was gathered in the late 50s through 1961. All areas of commercial timberland except the Eagle Cap Wilderness, Snake River Limited Area, and proposed Hell's Canyon Seven Devils Scenic Area were given some consideration for providing volume to the allowable cuts. The Minum area drainage outside of the Eagle Cap Wilderness area contains commercial timber which was included in the inventory and is contributing presently to the forest allowable cut. When the moratorium was established on this drainage in 1965, the timber sales program within the area were moved to other areas in need of cutting. Since all acres of commercial forest land are not cut annually, timber sales are scheduled on a priority basis. Stands with the greatest tree mortality are given first consideration. This is the letter that John Rogers wrote to me immediately following the hearing in LeGrand correcting misstatements on allowable cuts. The Minum timber is in allowable, it contributes to a degree. Presently, when the new management plan, whatever decisions are made to the element of this, is when the allowable cut determination will be made. I've heard the comments about the discoloration of the river for months or something following logging upon the Minum. I don't know whether we can attribute this to logging. I live there, I observe this river channel quite frequently. I've seen above the horse ranch the stockman's cabin, its area running real red various times in the summertime following heavy rainstorms. No logging whatsoever in these areas. This comes out of the Eagle Cap Wilderness, and this comes out of the area which we're talking about. That river runs red following a good heavy thunderstorm. So a lot of this thing that we see up there is being attributed to logging, certainly is earmarked improperly. Heard a comment on the South Salmon. I need to study the South Salmon. The problem of the South Salmon was the period, if you all remember, 1964-65 when the Dundee Bridge collapsed. What is happening to the mountainsides where there's no logging, big flushed out the mountainside due to heavy moisture and so on, and this is what happened in the Salmon River, not Morgan. I read the report. I have a copy of the report. Forest Service themselves, the study team, said that the logging hasn't contributed to this problem, but it's this weather factor. There is a problem on the channel, a very serious one. Grazing, they say there's no problem on grazing, but get around to some of these people where they go up on a wilderness mountainside and say, in the horrible sight of seeing this band of sheep out in a meadow, I suspect that these things are being analyzed very seriously about whether we're going to permit grazing in these areas. Fraserville does, but I question it. The poll mentioned in LeGrand, but I suspect that people didn't view the seriousness of this poll. They didn't make an effort to go out and make a big drive to get names on the poll. The people that was concerned did make an effort, so I don't think the poll is very representative of the sentiment in Union County. I'll agree that there it is a divided county, but not to the extent that we've been hearing. I'd like to, Mr. Chairman, I'll hurry through this, make a few comments on a letter in here. Concluding comments is a letter from John Rogers talking about the Wilderness Act, which became law in 1964. This Wilderness Act did not just recognize existing classified wilderness areas and give them protection under law. The Act also defined wilderness, required that the then existing classified as primitive areas be studied and reported on within 10 years. Set up a process under which additional areas besides those that then classified as primitive could be considered later on in the wilderness system. Establish a minimum list of reports and hearings and comments in which these things could be added to the wilderness. The requirement that the then existing primitive areas, in which I think there were 34 in number, be studied and reported on within 10 years, presented those with the responsible of doing this with a very difficult task. The chief of the Forest Service, early in 1965, stated that he hoped to complete his studies on the areas, the primitive areas, within 7 years. He indicated that he did know what time period the Bureau of Mines or Geological Survey had on there. Chief also stated at the same time the primitive area studies would have to be completed before any additional areas could be undertaken. They had a very difficult task with the 34, so all of the new areas had to be deferred. He asked patience on the part of those interested in these areas, of which the Minim is one of many. Consequently, Mr. Rogers said, I stated that until the Minim River area has been examined and reported on in accordance with the new Wilderness Act, no action would be taken to alter its present characteristics. By July 1972, the regional forester must identify and report upon unclassified areas warranting more intensive study for inclusion in the wilderness system. This study is nearly completed for the Minim area. It is hoped mineral and other surveys by the Geological Survey and the Bureau of the Mines will be completed in 1971. Their reports must be part of the record, and any significant facts they uncover included in the recommendations. We will, of course, adhere precisely to the provisions of the Wilderness Act as they have been interpreted for us. We must and do consider the desirability and need for additional wilderness. Such logical tracts of land as fit the wilderness definition contained in the law will be fully covered with the wilderness alternative in the report. We must recognize the need for an important We must recognize the need for and importance of areas of unroaded backcountry where minimum recreational facilities may exist. Such facilities, well planned and provided for, not only contribute to more pleasant experience, but also permit use by greater number of people. Site deterioration is unavoidable when there are heavy use of people and services not available for people. We believe that part of the Minum River lends itself to unroaded backcountry. The fact that minimum developments forbidden in the wilderness area may be installed is of importance if areas to make maximum contribution to public recreational needs. The Wilderness Act, if I remember, states there shall be no permanent developments. And I guess it's a matter of interpretation how you apply it is. To me, that is no permanent development, whether it's a bridge or building or other sanitary facilities and so on, camp tables. So one way to get that is to have roadless backcountry. In addition to the Minum area, there may be other smaller areas that should be considered for addition to the Eagle Cap Wilderness, and I think this is true too. So what I'm boiling this down to, studies haven't been completed. Studies will be completed, the Geological Survey, Bureau of Mines in 1971, and these reports will become part of the Forest Service's report recommendations, which I would assume will be completed shortly thereafter. We're still urging that we be calm and cool about this thing, and let's give our administrators an opportunity to do their job. I think cool-headedness should prevail. Shall we get studies? And I think it is easier to make decisions when you have all of the facts. Outdoors Unlimited pledges its total active support for an equitable solution to the Minum River, which includes consideration of all multiple use elements in managing our public lands and resources. Thank you.
Question for Mr. Park.
Pardon me, sir?
What is Outdoors Unlimited?
Outdoors Unlimited is a group of people from all walks of life that is concerned in management of public land. They include farmers, recreationists, cattlemen, miners, sportsmen, loggers, mechanics, lawyers. They're incorporated in Idaho. They encompass chapters scattered throughout the country now, because these same things are going on. They feel that they need an input in land management.
So sometimes hard for us to tell who's justifying for us when they wear different hats. But in fact, you're the land administrator for Boise Cascade Corporation in that region, aren't you?
That is correct, sir.
So does Boise Cascade have any land within this area?
We do, yes. We own the section 16 at the mouth of Murphy Creek, and the commonly called as the land ranch at the junction of the Minum and the Little Minum. I'd like to say this, that a lot of people have inferred that Boise Cascade purchased this and was going to do certain things and so on, but they didn't. This was purchased by the Hefner Lumber Company back in 1952, which ultimately became part of Boise Cascade.
Are you presently logging any of your lands within the proposed area?
No, sir. There is a moratorium. There is an attachment to the letter I reviewed with you from John Rogers, which indicates there is a moratorium on the Minum, which there will be no timber harvesting in the River Canyon, no road building until studies and final determination has been made of this river channel. So in effect, the Minum has been saved.
But as a practical matter, unless sometime in the future you are allowed to harvest your
lines that you own are relatively useless to a company like Fort Cascade, are they not?
In effect, this is true, that when this land was purchased in 52, several years before, there was a minor river issue.
Would you consider donating them to the public?
Well, Mr. Anderson indicated there was a land exchange. Well,
really,
in effect, there isn't a land exchange yet. It hasn't been signed by both parties, but I presume it will ultimately be a fact.
And you're talking about that. The negotiations are going on with the Forest Service, are they?
The negotiations aren't going on now. This is part of a master plan involving other properties and so on. So when this management plan, or this what it is, a management plan, acquisition plan, becomes a reality, then these two parcels is part of the overall program.
Well, I'm only about half serious about your donating again, because it seems like every time there's a donation or something, well, the corporation will get stuck for it, but there's going to be a great controversy about it. Land swap does seem to be reasonable, and people in that area want to preserve. Well, I have to commend you for that.
Chairman?
Is there
an hour? Didn't Boise Cascade talk about donating river at the junction of the minor, the little minor, the state of Oregon?
We did that 5 years ago,
It's
been quite a little while, and we had a difficult time of getting a meeting of minds on how to donate it, and this hasn't been done yet. This area was access to another big area, which we wanted to have traffic to it, very light traffic. The State Parks Department didn't want us to be donated this way, so we've been studying the area quite carefully since that time, and I think we found another access around this area. It's not desirable access, but it is a way around.
I'd like to cooperate with you in getting that land in the State Parks. Good.
Thank you. We try to donate this, as I said, about 5 years ago. We're in process negotiating now. I don't know what the outcome it'll be, but there should be some settlement on it, I would presume, in 71.
I'll be in contact with you.
Thank you, sir.
Are my people in Wild County rightly concerned about the economic impact of this and computing the allowable cut? When I go back to them after this meeting, they tell them that there's no need to be concerned because it really doesn't affect them, or does it affect them?
Mr. Patterson, they certainly need to be concerned. It's to the extent we feel that the $82,000 is not necessary to protect the mine. Something less than this, I think everybody could live with. I hope that the wilderness advocates could live with it. I think the timber industry could live with it, but the $82,000 we still feel is too large. Just to give you a figure here, it is in some of these figures, backup data I gave you. When you get to considering economics, the allowable cut has just recently been calculated for the Wallow equipment, and it has increased for this area by 25.2% over what it was a year ago. This has gone into the new inventories. Again, depending on how you draw the boundary, the allowable cut on this whole package is still roughly 10 million feet annually. We've heard figures as low as a million, and this is why we try to prevail upon going slow on this, so we get studies, so we're all talking about the same thing. We all had a different set of facts. And the conversion of the January 1, 1970 cost of converting a tree in an operation similar to ours, where we got particle board, plywood, sawmills, and so on, about $114,000 per million voted feet. People don't realize this. Then when you multiply it by your volumes and take this out of a community, it's got to have an impact. So they rightly so they need to be concerned.
Further questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Barnes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. We appreciate having the opportunity to speak with you.
Russ Jolly.
I'm Russ Jolly. I'm representing the Oregon Environmental Council. Getting a little late. There's been a lot of testimony, and I'm going to simply say that our Environmental Council strongly supports this resolution and is in agreement with those people who feel that there is an increasing need for wilderness, which is increasing faster than the need for timber on this type of area. One of the criteria, I believe, for deciding how to judge between wilderness preservation and economic use in terms of timber management is the productivity of the land. And the productivity of this valley is low. Along the river, it's fairly good. Productivity along the high sides of the valley is extremely low. And I'd like to show you, if I may, show you this map. This is a forest type map made by the federal government. And this shows Northeast Oregon. And the Wallowa, you see the area. The other is the silver, mountain hemlock, white fir. There's very little evidence for you to understand. There's some, but it's never. These are represented by the dark green. Almost the entire Eagle Cap Wilderness, shown inside of this blue line here, this is the Eagle Cap Wilderness, is entirely light colored. This is alpine or completely non-forested. And there are one or two very thin stringer stands. Here's a stringer stand, including a little bit of ponderosa pine coming along this valley in the mountains. The rest of this, when you look at the hillside, it's forested. Yes, forested with alpine firs, with white bark pine. Things are not even commercial. Some days it may be commercial, but their cutting cycle of those things might be 500 years. And here is the proposed addition of the Minim. Now, here is a little bit more timber. There's more timber in the Minim Valley than there is in the present Eagle Cap. Let's compare it to the Eastern Oregon. Like that, it's flat. A lot of these areas flat or rolling. And so I just wanted to point this out as give some perspective to this question of deciding about questions of wilderness versus well, site class for ponderosa pine or Douglas fir. Well, I think they have a type site, and I would guess that a type site in the very bottom of the Minor River, down at the lower end, that is inside the forest boundary, right in here, might be type site 3. But certainly, type sites up in here would be 4, and certainly 4 and 5. It might be 3, might even be a little bit of 2, as good as 2. But I'm not much of a judge of ponderosa pine type site. But Douglas fir type site, of course, I mean, the productivity of that valley is nothing compared to a valley a tenth that size over in the Coast Range. But, of course, that doesn't mean that the people in Wallowa County don't have to have an economic base for their existence. The question is this Minor River really going to take out a substantial amount? And when you consider the commercial timber that's in this valley, you'll see. You can see that dip down to ponderosa pine is right on the creek. It's not even an eighth of a mile either side. Here it's maybe as much as half a mile or so on the side. Here comes the Minor River right through here, and the ponderosa pine. Now, if you're going to leave the river alone, where are you going to get your timber? Because essentially there's no timber. This is absolutely timber free here. And these are alpine type sites, and this is lodgepole pine over here, the type 4. I'd say we're arguing about if the Wallowa County economic base depends upon whether the Minor River Valley or its health or lack of health depends upon whether the Minor River Valley is exploited to the hilt for its timber value, then it's very much on the basis of looking at forest type map. That concludes my statement.
Thank you very much. One question. Mr. Fred Hall and Mr. Parsons, you agree generally with the site classification? Not at all. Okay.
Excuse me, I don't understand. Do I agree with their...
No, I was just asking if they agree with your explanation.
Oh, I see. Well,
the date of the map for...
This map essentially is correct, except for the change is the increased amount of cutting that has been existing there.
Okay,
sorry.
I didn't mean to start a debate between you.
I'm sorry.
I just wanted to.
The only other thing that may be incorrect here is that there was a fire in the Anthony Lake area in 1960, which would put a big red area in that one. Well,
Mr. Booker, Buker.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Buker. I'm speaking here both as a private citizen and as a member of the, of course, now defunct Scenic Rivers Steering Committee, which passed the initiative. I wasn't going to speak today, but there were so many questions come up on the scenic rivers, and of course I'm working from memory, but I think I could clear a few of those up. As far as the scenic rivers being holding on the federal government, it actually isn't at the present time. However, the Federal Scenic Rivers Act provides that any state that passes a scenic rivers bill or designate sections of their rivers as scenic rivers upon a application from the governor of that state to the federal government, they will include that in the Federal Scenic Rivers Act itself. So as soon as that is done, this area will be under the Federal Scenic Rivers Act, and that will be binding on all government agencies, whether state or federal. Another thing on the Scenic Rivers Bill, it was finally brought out that this only covers the river for 1/4 mile on each side. Now, this bill was designed to encompass different types of areas, wild scenic areas and areas that were maybe not predominantly agriculture, but there was agriculture along through. It had to be written to the extent where it would protect as much as we could, still leave the private citizen alone as much as possible. Now, we would like to have made it a lot stronger, believe me, but we figured that this was as strong a bill as we possibly could get through and get passed. We tried for two sessions down here to get it passed. It was in conjunction with a trails bill, which we eliminated from it to get away from the resistance to the trails part of it, so we could get some protection on these rivers before it was too late. Now, as far as the Wilderness Act is concerned, the Scenic Rivers Bill will give a certain amount of protection to the heavy sands of timber that lay along the river, I understand. I might add that I am not at all familiar with the Wyndham. The Looking Glass area that these people are talking about that has been completely ruined, that's my hunting grounds, and you might know that I'm hunting for new hunting grounds because they strip logged it and ruined it down to where we have pack animals, and actually we could almost pack the pack animals into a little bit of wild area we have left on Looking Glass. The one thing that I'm quite concerned with here is the spawning. In the whole Columbia River system, we have in the past years had a tremendous main stem spawning going on. Fall Chinook, steelhead, we have lost that due to one dam after another until at the present time we have approximately, I'm pretty sure it's 57 miles on the Columbia River is all the free-flowing main stem of that river left. On the Snake, we have a little over 100 from the upper part of Lower Goose Reservoir to Hell's Canyon Dam. And they're trying to take another 40 miles of that with Lower Granite, which we are fighting in court in Spokane at the present time. We have lost all this main stem spawning. We have to depend for our anadromous fish runs on hatcheries, on the few tributaries that we have left. And our tributaries themselves are getting in very short supply. We have lost now the North Fork of the Clearwater River. They have a number of dams proposed on the salmon. I think we can head those off. Grand Round, they have a couple of dams on those that they're thinking of building, and I understand one on there at the present time. We have stopped the dams on the John Day and the Deschutes. But there still is not enough spawning area left. Now that soil up there, I understand, is very, very unstable. And it wouldn't take too much of it in the Minum River to silt up the gravel to an extent where, for spawning purposes, it would be completely ruined. And gentlemen, in my thinking, our spawning areas are getting very, very critical. And I would hate to see this ruined for the sake of cutting a few timber, a little timber at the present time. Thank you.
Representative Anderson, if we designate a river as whatever that Scenic River is, who in Washington, D.C. puts it in under the federal list?
I would have to read the law again. It's Congress, I believe. I believe it's Congress. But it's an automatic setup. We had a write-up nationally over the fact that Oregon was the first one to take advantage of that provision of the Federal Scenic Rivers Act.
Is it possible we're taking the wrong approach?
Well, the Scenic Rivers Act itself Representative Anderson, would not give us the protection we need, because they can still cut timber. Representative McPherson says it had a lot of balderdash in it probably, but it was probably necessary to get this passed by the people. But it does give a certain amount of protection, there's no question about it, but not enough to keep an area intact like this. It was never intended for this purpose. We have even included parts of wilderness areas in the scenic rivers because there was private lands along the river, and this would give us some control of those private lands to keep them from putting in rock crusher or building the slaughterhouse along the river or stuff like that.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your patience. Paul Danielson. Signed up. Are there any others? We've gone a long time on this. We're probably going to have another hearing on it, I'm sure. And we appreciate your testimony and your patience.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to note for the record that Representative Densmore left the committee hearing at 2 o'clock, and it's now 4:45, and he has not since returned. And I just want to put that on the record, as some of us who've had to sit through these hearings, it's objectionable to me that he would leave without the excuse of the chairman.
Committee stands adjourned.
With the correction division, 1167, and because there have been a number of requests on this, I did ask, we're not going to conduct this in the form of a hearing, but I asked Amos Reed and some people from the correction division to be here. Some of the committee members have a problem in understanding, want to get this a little bit more clear in their mind. 1167 transfers, as it said on the front, the foster home place from the student juvenile school from the superintendent to the administrator of the corrections division.
That's the one I have a question.
All right, Chairman.
Joe,
go right ahead.
When you originally sent this bill,
when you sit up there, Joe,
I marked in my book here.
Joe Fim,
associate administrator of juvenile services in the corrections division. A concern that I had, and I asked you to come back just to make sure, that this bill takes the decision process away, further away, from the people who are actually working with the children. And that concerned me as being a step in the wrong direction. I misinterpreted the bill, and I'm not getting corrected.
I think I can understand how we can get sort of polarized here. Just to give you a little bit of background, 2 years ago, let me go back 4 years ago, I think I mentioned this at the previous hearing, Legislative Ways and Means asked the Corrections Division to consider bringing the two separate juvenile parole programs together under the Corrections Division Central Office as a Central Office administered program. Previously, historically, juvenile parole has been operated under the authority of each of the superintendents separately of Hillcrest and McLaren. Ways and Means gave us the directive. 2 years ago, we received more encouragement to some initial steps we took between 67 and 69. And last July, we did pull both parole programs together under a program manager at the corrections division level. Now, in the 69th session, there was legislation, two parts of which. One was that children, rather than being committed to Hillcrest and McLaren, are now committed to the Corrections Division. The legal custody of the children go to the Corrections Division and they're placed in McLaren and Hillcrest. That's number one. Number two was that the legislation of 2 years ago, the authority for paroling youngsters was given to the Corrections Division Administrator and or his delegate. This bill carries this operation one step further. Actually, it almost delegates a kind of a functionary assignment, which is finally approving foster home placement of a youngster, transferring that paper signing authority from the superintendent of the institution to the new program manager of the juvenile parole program. Now, specifically your question, the decision-making apparatus is one that takes place during the time the youngster is in an institution. Parole is involved in that process of decision-making, but the decision as to when a youngster is ready to be placed in the community on parole is one that is made by way of a recommendation with parole participation by the staff of the institution. And those decisions are monitored by the superintendent of the institution. And if he feels that a youngster is not ready for parole and not ready for a recommendation of foster placement along with parole, he can present his opinion most forcefully to his staff members.
I know. Let me just say, previously, Mr. Reed, for example, would have to make a decision on the paper void whether or not he should be sent out to foster care.
Right.
I suppose that not being personal contact with that boy, perhaps he'd call in a counselor and maybe the living group supervisor or whatever to get a sort of a composite of the boy. Now, are those same people going to be putting input into this process, or is it just the Mr. Reed up there as an advocate for the boy?
No, there are people along the line who are advocates for the child. I think that the process that we now have operating provides more in the way of advocacy for the youngster than previously because we have a tension operating. We have two different viewpoints. Let me give you an example. A few weeks ago, we had a difference of opinion around the placement of a youngster in a particular group home setting. The difference of opinion was that Mr. Pfeiffer, superintendent of the institution, and his staff were recommending that this youngster be placed in this particular group home. The manager of the parole program and his staff were recommending against it. They were at loggerheads. They brought the case to me. And I made the decision in support of the superintendent and his staff in this instance. I only cite this as a way of saying that we have also built into this process different levels of decision making. And I hope overall that we have come up with a kind of a homogenized, unified operation rather than one that is discordant.
So,
Chair,
Representative Cole, the Corrections Division now determines whether or not a youngster put on probation from one of the juvenile institutions?
Not probation, parole.
Parole.
From the institution, yes.
The difference?
The difference between probation and parole?
Is there such a thing as probation from the institution?
No, not from the institution,
right.
From the court.
Okay, now, the House recently passed House Bill 1125, which gave the Corrections Division authority to place in juvenile homes with youngsters from 18 to 21. What effect is this present bill 1167 going to have as far as disposition of those older youngsters?
Mr. Reed could support me perhaps in more detail on this. That particular bill provides that the Corrections Division, at its discretion, can place a youngster, I think, between the ages of 16 and 21, who has been convicted, at least who has been sentenced for commission of a felony to the Corrections Division, can, at its discretion, place that youngster from OCI or from the Women's Center into one of the juvenile institutions if the particular individual can profit better for in this juvenile setting than the adult setting.
And then on now, apparently, to a foster.
And, well, I think this is the hooker here that you might have some opinions on, Amos. I think that the statutes would apply in terms of post-institutional planning are very much tied in with the fact that this individual is a felon rather than a juvenile. In other words, the parole planning or post-institutional planning is something that will have to be carried out primarily, at least, by the adult probation and parole staff as parole is authorized by the parole board, and planning, in effect, is approved by the parole board.
Now, do you have something to add on that?
It does pose a sticky question. I
parole board would have jurisdiction.
Parole board would have jurisdiction.
Mr. Chairman,
question.
Presently, the circuit judge or the juvenile judge will commit a youngster to Hill or to McLaren, or does he commit the youngster to the Department of Corrections?
To the Corrections Division.
The Corrections, yes, they
right. I see. And then the statute provides that we place the youngster in the facility.
And also the release of that youngster is entirely up to the Department of Corrections.
It's up to the administrator and or his delegate. And now what this is providing is foster placement of the youngster by the division administrator and his or his delegate.
One other question. Concerning youth care centers, does this bill affect the placement by a juvenile judge of a youngster to a youth care center? Does he have to go through the Department of Corrections to do this?
No. No. The commitment of youngsters to the youth care center is directly on order of the juvenile court judge to the youth care center in lieu of commitment to the corrections division.
Other questions?
Ready? Want a motion?
Yep.
I'll move that this be sent to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Representative Phil from the House Bill 1167 to the floor with a new pass recommendation. Further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk call the roll.
Hamilton.
Aye. Alcorn.
Aye.
Cole.
Aye.
Dinsmore.
Aye.
Howard.
Aye.
Engel.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Kennedy.
Aye.
McPherson.
Aye.
Patterson.
Aye.
Phillips.
Aye.
Martin.
Aye.
So ordered, Representative Hamilton, Chair 1167.
No.
The question was, should this go to Ways and Means, and is there any potential cost?
No, essentially what they're doing now anyway.
Currently, the foster home placement and parole staff budget is under the institution. This is being combined in the central office budget, as a correction to the central office budget during the next 5 years. So there is essentially nothing to change in terms of pay.
Sorry,
no, it's fine. I'm glad you did. Let's make sure we are clear on these bills. House Bill 1169 is another Corrections Division bill which authorizes the sale of inmate-made hobby and recreational materials without the label prison-made on it, and allows them to put this money into an account for distribution when they get out, or as spending money. Representative McPherson moves House Bill 1169 to the floor due pass. Is there discussion? Seeing none, clerk call roll.
I noticed this was lot of limits on place of sale.
Door to door.
You people deal with it here.
Third call roll.
Anderson.
Aye.
Ockline.
Aye.
Cole.
Aye.
Danhoff.
Aye.
Howard.
Aye.
Engel.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Kennedy.
Aye.
Baker.
Aye.
Patterson.
Aye.
Bassett.
Aye.
Bill.
Aye.
Martin.
Aye.
Representative Howard, would you care that place?
Sorry, we'll change that.
Representative
McPherson's going to carry
that.
No, fine.
I don't
want to
kid.
I'm glad
that you got all the good bills.
Going on.
Gee, I got
the OPCI
bill.
I thought he was looking mad. Hospital 1171. This authorizes the Corrections Department to transfer women inmates to either the federal government or to county institutions. The program presently is not being done with the federal government under contract.
Yes, we have a contract with the federal government and with two or three states, and we are developing contracts with counties. And we have this well developed for men, and this will just clean it up and make us in a position to do this with women.
Representative Kennedy moves House Bill 1171 to the floor.
One question.
Representative Stoltz?
I'd like some comment on the phrase female inmates appearing in line 8.
We amended that. It should,
okay.
As it is,
Chairman.
Okay.
Female
as amended. I don't know if you need an amendment to correct the misspelling.
I don't think so.
Chairman, I have one question on line 8 and 9 there. It says, for a prison for the confinement and detention of female inmates, and deleting and, that is not a party to the Western Interstate Corrections Compact. Is that significant? And so, why that is not a Western Interstate Correction?
I think that. You want to answer that? Does that not have
this extends it? The legislature has already provided for our participation in the Western Interstate Corrections Compact. This would extend it there. Not all states are participants, but this does make it possible for us. This would make it possible for us to enter into a contract with those who are not presently participants in the compact.
Repeal the compact.
Further questions? Seeing none, the clerk call the roll.
Anderson.
Aye.
Ockline.
Aye.
Cole.
Aye.
Dinsmore.
Aye.
Howard.
Aye.
Ingalls.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Kennedy.
Aye.
McPherson.
Aye.
Patterson.
Aye.
Bassett.
Aye.
Stoltz.
Aye.
Martin.
Aye. So ordered, Representative Dinsmore. There are further questions. Does this come before the whole committee? Everybody know we. And adjourned subcommittee will meet at 1:30. State and Federal Affairs Subcommittee will come to order. We'll first hear testimony on House Bill 1089. I'd like to call on Representative Sam Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have to confess that notice that went to me mentioned 1140, House Bill 1140, about which I am not informed at this time, and I came down just to see what the situation was, and then you explained to me that I am a sponsor of 1089. House Bill 1089 is the intent of it is quite obvious from the summarization. which authorizes the state of Oregon political subdivisions agencies to bring action to recover triple damages for intentional injury to public property. Establishes parental liability and designates for the minors and so on. We in the forestry field, in the lumber business, have faced triple damages for a long time, and sometimes our trespassing is not willful. And others of you in other industries, businesses, know that there is a penalty damage clause in many areas. We definitely know that some of the vandalism that goes on in our schools and universities and elsewhere, public buildings and so forth, are just that, willful vandalism. And we very often know the people that perpetrated. I think it's high time, and many other people join with me in thinking it's high time that some action be taken. I think we've excused this attitude too long. We have a brand new, beautiful $4 million high school in Redmond. And before the school was open, the inside, there was about $10,000 worth of damage done to the inside. They found the people. Now, if the children can't be corralled, then some way we've got to involve the parents in it. Now, I know this is a harsh bill, and I know that many people will shake their heads thinking that it is too harsh, either on the children or on the parents, in particular the parents who are not in a position to make restitution three times over. But some way, I think we've got to drive home the point that we are serious about this, that something has to be done to more than a slap on the wrist or a suspension from school for a week or two. I didn't have anything to do with drawing the bill, Mr. Chairman. But when I had an opportunity to sign it, I did sign it for the reasons that I have given.
I'm one of the sponsors also, and for the same reason that you did, I was not instrumental in drafting it. It was brought out to me, and if you look in section, page 2, section 1, sub 3, wherein it says that if the defendant has no estate and he's under the age of 21, and the parents or parents having legal custody may be named as defendants, and if named, be liable for treble the amount of damages assessed. They bring up the point, a 20-and-a-half-year-old child who left the home at age 18 and has been gone for 2.5 years blows up a building at the University of Oregon and does $1 million of the damages. Are the parents liable for $3 million? And the point being that the child left home at age 18, mm-hmm. and for instance, let's say it's a woman or girl, mm-hmm. and there have been some that have taken up this mm-hmm. bombing. Are the parents then liable?
Well,
what do we do in the case?
I am not also familiar with equity and what it means and where the lines are drawn. I think there is such a thing as compromising these things in the court. But I do think that it ought to be brought forth and effort should be made to place the blame where it is if the court sees fit to, or the jury sees fit to reduce this liability. That's one thing. But somewhere along the line, I urge, and I really think this, Mr. Chairman, I think that if this committee passed out this bill, difficult it would be for the House members and the Senate members, if it goes through the Senate committee, to vote on it. And I know it would be an agonizing situation for some members because they don't feel quite as strongly as I do about it, but I think you'd be doing the state and the legislature a benefit by bringing this bill out and letting all of us be counted.
Mr. Chairman, I was just wondering where time has changed, or we had this bill in here about 3 sessions ago to raise that 300 to 500, and we couldn't get everybody in the room as far as liability was concerned by the parents being liable on line 25.
Mm-hmm.
And today there's, I don't know if there's anybody here to testify on or not. I think that this might be an indication of how people have come to think that maybe we should put some damage on.
Yes, I think we do. And I think the public who are not in the educational area community are looking to us for guidance. I think there's all kinds of indication of that. And we do represent those people, not special interests, but the public at large, who are becoming frightened.
Sam, on this whole thing, we have on everything we do, we have a gray area between 18 years of age and 21. Parents call and want to know from me about insurance.
That's right.
Are they liable? It seems that we would ought to make a stand someplace and have legislative counsel define what this gray area is. Between 18 and 21, where would they stand in this?
Well, I'm of the group that wants them to be given not only their voting rights at 18, because that's what they're going to get. We can't.
You want to give them.
I want to give them the majority at 18.
And make them punishable if they.
I don't want them to be able to go downtown and vote and not be able to have a glass of beer when they get home. I think one warrants the other.
This would be the only section that would bother me. This would be the one you mentioned.
In Denmark?
Yeah, I was about to follow up with a similar question. Could you explain the difference between the provisions of amending 30.770 there? In other words, they talk later about 18 years or younger, and then up above they're talking about 21 years of age, under 21. Do you think that's basically inconsistent? Both sections be the same?
Well, it says, in addition to any further remedies allowed by law and except as that provided in subject one of this 1971 Act, that's what you're referring to, the parents are in so-and-so. I think it is tied together from a legal point of view. But this incorporates the actions of any child at any age. And I think the parents should realize that. Too often the parent, and you know that from your own experience in the educational world, the parents are the first ones down there defending their children against the principal or against the superintendent or something. And I think we should take it out of his hands, and he just says, well, there it is. You've got to answer to the general public, not just this school board or your friends or those who sympathize with you.
I don't want to follow up by saying that I do have some real problems with this first section up here with under 21 years of age, because I don't think that reasonably parents have the capacity, you know, the real capacity to
hold
those young people on college campus.
No, I don't know that at all.
I think
we should get them off the college campus until they develop an attitude and a frame of mind that the expensive education we're giving them is of some value.
Well, if you follow what I'm saying, I'm not saying.
Maybe you don't.
In order to tie something into law, we have to give people the capacity to implement what we do. I agree with the chairman's concern that, particularly in that case cited about a young girl, let's say, or someone who leaves home at 18 to go to school or do whatever it is she does, and she goes to school and then decides to become a bomber, and the kids aren't, you see what I'm saying? The parent has no capacity.
No, I don't agree with you saying. I think the parent has a capacity and should exercise it.
Child has left home and terminated the relationship.
In many cases, the parents aren't exercising. They throw up their hands. I think the whole thing ought to be involved. Now, if the child or the parent is really concerned about this, I imagine there's certain legal proceedings that they can go through to rid themselves of this legal liability. We just want it both ways. We want the heart and the love and affection, but none of the responsibility. If we got a bad apple, it's yours, not mine.
Again, President Duncan, my feeling is that
we better, under
18, I think they have the capacity to implement what we would
like to do.
Well,
we better get the parents involved then, whole public. And we'll have letters in the newspapers. I am no longer responsible for the... Just say we do it with wives and husbands and the rest. There's legal procedures, I'm sure. I want to get it out in the open. We've got 5 years with these routine bombings and one thing or another. I think we understand the problem. The public has become aware of it. I think somewhere along the line we ought to all take it up, or the ones that are doing it ought to stop.
Do you have one more question to have? Do you see any problem with a student who is in Oregon that is an out-of-state student and the parents being able to control what they do?
I don't know where the jurisdiction goes, but if they've got a bomb thrower, I think they just and they keep in California. If they don't, I just don't have the parents involved. Let's bring it out. If they want to fight, let's fight. Let's stop just patting them on the back and telling them there's something their father did or their mother did that put them off the track. And a little bomb throwing is going to help them. I don't think it is. And I don't think it's going to help us either.
Mr. Chairman, let's not get off the track now. We're not only talking about bomb throwers here. We're talking about kids that go in and mutilate the inside of a school building.
I hope it's
yes, sir. Below 18, we can see how we can tie it to the parents.
I hope the bomb throwers are not maliciously intent on murder. I'm assuming it's just vandalism. Now, maybe your bomb throwers have got a different viewpoint. My bomb throwers are only vandalism.
I think it's going to be circumstances that cause a bomb thrower to. They phone and say, get everybody out of the building, but if it goes off prematurely, like it did in Wisconsin, then they kill somebody.
But you were asking if this could apply to vandalism. I do think so. This is what it's designed for, really. I don't think it's a bomb throwing within the intent of this bill.
I would like to see somebody from the courts here to sit and listen to some of this, because if the courts would pass some sentences, we wouldn't have some of this problem. They catch them all the time.
I agree with you.
I think you go through the whole thing without asking the recovered people to start firing.
I could take care of
it. Sam, thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm sorry I didn't have more technical information, but as I explained to you, I saw the bill. I wanted to sponsor it because I'm proud to be on some of this thing to let the public know some of us are kind of aware of their worries. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there further testimony on House Bill 1089?
Hang on, that ends the testimony on 1089.
We'll move now to House Bill 1140. Gordon L. Osborne.
I'm Gordon Osborne, the Vice President of the Oregon Association of Marriage Counselors. And as such, we are concerned, our organization is concerned, about the bill, House Bill 1140. Our concerns have been outlined in a letter to each of you as legislators, but if I may just cover the main points on it. First, we question the practicality of implementing the premarital counseling and its education for family living court. At the present time, there are very few persons who are qualified to teach such a course or to teach the potential approved teacher. Second, even if sufficiently or sufficient number of approved teachers were available, we questioned the effectiveness of the method. By the time the couple is committed to the idea of marriage, it is difficult for them to consider and anticipate a possible problem. The old adage, love is blind, is not too inaccurate. Third, the bill makes no provision for payment of the teachers of the premarital courses, meaning either the teachers offer courses on a private fee-charging basis, or the educational institutions somehow consider inclusion of such courses in their curriculum. Now, a fourth concern, we seriously doubt that increasing the waiting period from 7 to 30 days would have any effect on delaying impulsive marriages. Now, I think a basic principle here, if you've got a law, you should be able to enforce it, and in effect, I don't think you can, because they can go to adjoining states. And to me, that's an important principle, at least as a marriage counselor and working with children, that when you say something, you're able to follow through. Now, Mr. Kott, the other day, presented a great deal of documentation for the problem, and I'd be the first to admit there's a real problem. But as far as this being the solution to it, I have some real serious questions, as do our organization. Now, first, we value the impact of education, but would recommend an ongoing inclusion in the primary and secondary public school curriculum of family life education before persons are emotionally committed to a marriage. Second, we recommend any efforts to strengthen services to improve the quality of family life in our society, in our culture. The family is the incubator of the human species. The very best education for successful marriage is the experience of the child growing up in a relatively healthy, normal, stable family. Here he learns the firsthand the appropriate roles of husbands, wives, fathers, mothers. Identification and modeling are effective ways to learn behavior. These are our basic concerns and recommendations. We again recognize the problem, which we have a solution that substitute for it. But the question that this would be the most effective way. Thank you.
Mr. Osborne.
Yes.
What, do you have any objections to, say, the creation of this Oregon Council on Marriage and Family Living? Perhaps not going the full extent of the bill, but the creation of a council
that would address itself to these
kinds of stuff? This subject, and then perhaps later get into the thing of possible course with the teacher and what the qualifications.
That sounds fine. No question about that. I think there needs to be some vehicle for directing our energies to this problem. This may be one of them.
The question? And then,
would you favor, what we're talking about, I think, is trying to impress upon the minds of young people who are going to get married, desire to learn things about the steps they're going to take. In other words, make the marriage decision a lot more complicated, make it something harder, that they have to really decide something when they're going to get married. You also follow on the other end of the spectrum that we should try to make the same effort on divorce. In other words, I sense that we're becoming much more permissive in letting people have divorces than we were before. In other words, California, I think, has gone to a law where you just, have to say that you just can't get along and you pretty much get divorced. Do you think we need to make the same effort at the other end of the scale, which I think we're trying to say in
second? I certainly agree that we should. I'm not quite sure of the vehicle for doing that. And I'm not sure that more stringent legislation on divorce is the way to approach it. But I share your concern. And, I've talked with people that were ready for divorce and at the same time rebuilt the marriage with them. And if they didn't have a chance to talk with someone or find some other way to get to this, why they would have been divorced. And divorce usually is a fairly destructive experience for most people. It's not always, but it certainly can be, as I'm sure we all know from acquaintances.
Mr. Howard.
Mr. Osborne, what would be achieved by setting up section 1 and 2, if eventually we weren't going to go on with the rest of the bill, what would be, would be setting up a approved teachers is in there, the marriage counselor and all this, what would be the purpose of this group?
Are you referring to Representative Martin's comment?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't interpret his comment in this specific,
yeah,
just to a general.
General, what would be the purpose of them? What would these people do if they're set up in a council?
I would presume that they would, like Mr. Cox did before, examine the problem and make some constructive suggestions in terms of how to deal with the problem. We know the problem exists, and you know who's going to direct their energies and efforts to resolving it, and perhaps a committee that had that assignment might be productive. But if, as far as approving teachers, et cetera, I don't see that's too detailed.
But we would set up this, and there's a $15,000 budget in this bill, or that's what they're asking for. And I can't see what they would do in a 2-year period. They couldn't approve any teachers. Unless we're going to carry it through with it, if you, your testimony, I think, led me to believe that this is pretty complicated. Such a thing as about now, about a large percentage of the young kids that don't get married, the girl's already pregnant. What good is it going to do to send them to somebody to study the problem?
Well, I wouldn't see this as sending them to someone to study the problem. I would see a group of people, not so much handling individual cases, but as a committee that would take a look at solutions. Now, Mr. Cox took a look at the problem, and I think documented very well. If an ample or an equal investment were made in documenting solutions that may have been tried.
There's no doubt that we have the problem.
I'm sure we can.
I think what we're looking for is an answer, and I can't see we're setting up another commission is going to solve the problem. I think that perhaps if we would take a look at one of our senators suggested sometime that we might, not too long ago, that we might pay the wife to, instead of working on the outside, pay her to take care of her own kids. This might be an answer.
And I would see a committee like this look into possible solutions. That's the only comment I would refer to.
That's all.
Further questions, Mr. Osborne? Mr. Dinsmore.
Mr. Osborne, do you have a bill there that you can, I think, Section 4 addresses itself to what the council would do. I don't know about any abbreviated proposal that amendments that are coming up, but do you think if this would be roughly the charge and the duties of the council that it would justify its existence?
Yes, this fits more with what I understood the question to be from the chairman.
Mark. Mr. Osborne, I apologize for being late, but this whole bill strike is a problem that already exists. Really, shouldn't we be looking at the source of the problem prior to when people get to whatever age they begin to get married?
Sure.
Should this be whatever it is done at school more adequately?
And within the families, if we can find some way to do that too. But I see the school as a problem. Yes, that's right.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Austin. Very cool.
I'm here to speak for the Oregon Council on Family Relations, which is a cross-disciplinary group of professional people here in the state, and it is affiliated with the National Council on Family Relations. Also, I teach marriage and family relations at Oregon State University. And I would like to tell you what the executive committee of the council would like me to bring to you. And, of course, I wouldn't be here if I didn't go along with it. They would like to say that we feel that with the providing of a council on marriage and family living, we would highlight and focus the attention of citizens in the state on this very important process of learning how to make give a chance to a marriage. Now, in my teaching, I learned that so many of the students wish they had learned 5 years before we get them at the university level what some of the risks and some of the responsibilities would be. In other words, our mass media gives them romantic ideas. We try to bring realism. And I believe that a council on marriage and family living at the state level could begin to work through ways that we could approach this huge, gigantic problem of preparedness, if you want to use that word. We socialize people for all kinds of vocations. We socialize them and prepare them in skills. But what do we do about the skill of interpersonal consciousness? And this is what I feel that I'm bringing from the others in the group.
Are you speaking to the whole bill? Do you agree with the bill which sets up requirements for counselors, etc.?
I think there are certain areas in the bill that we would feel we would want to look at more because of the difficulty, for instance, in finding enough counselors or finding enough counselors.
You were speaking to the concept of the...
of the council, the state-appointed council.
Mr. Denmore, would you agree with the statement that this might be more properly placed in the Department of Education?
I personally think not. I think that there would have to be synthesis with the Department of Education. But I think that the emphasis that would be placed on the welfare and well-being of all the citizens of the state, I think, should come through legislative representative action.
You're aware, I'm sure, of the problem of coordinating many government agencies.
Oh, indeed.
And I can think of your argument, your stand is well taken, that we need to highlight this by creating the council, but my experience, or at least the observation, after a short time after that's been done, then it's just another agency that has to be coordinated with other agencies, perhaps with similar responsibilities. I think of every piece of federal legislation I think has ever been passed has been because someone wanted to highlight the solution of a particular problem. But now you're coming up with so many different programs going in different directions that you need to bring order out of chaos. My concern is if we can decide on where this might go, that it might be better for us to proceed as this is a function we would like to see done. And rather than just create a commission and to make proposals, create something, charge somebody with doing it, and go in that direction. It is the Department of Education, then, or is it something we could charge various things to do, various existing agencies? Now, would you say still that this must be an Oregon Council of Marriage, is something that's so important in and of itself that must be established?
I personally feel that it would be a very good first step. All dreams, in order to become reality, have to have a first step. And other states are now moving in this direction. I'd like to see real motion here. The students believe it's relevant, believe me. They believe it's relevant.
Further questions to Mr. Booth? Thank you very much. Dr. Crawshaw.
My name is Dr. Crawford. I'm an obstetrician and gynecologist, have been in the Salem area for some 20-odd years. I'm not particularly representing anyone. I have been involved with Mr. Katz in development of this somewhat. He asked several of us a couple months ago to look over his ideas, and we did so. I think the idea is tremendous. I think that if it's appropriate, I personally would like to congratulate Mr. Kopp for this, because this is above and beyond his duty. And I think it's entirely on the basis of his caring for human beings. I myself have been involved with the nitty-gritty of these things for 20-some-odd years, as it says. It's a little different than the educational establishment handling this. It's a little more real than that. I personally would like to see this expanded somewhat. Mr. Cox's thesis of education being the only valid method, really, is very, very true, but then you have to define education. If you mean education within the school system, that's one thing. If you mean education for family living, the reality of the community as it exists, that's another. And sometimes those two things don't exactly mesh always. I've had some experience in one in our community when they call family life education, that several years ago, a group of us here did try and establish this family life education system or sponsor it in the Salem School District. And while we have made strides, yet essentially it was shot down because the public in general looks at this as sex education rather than the broader terms of what we're talking about, the realities of marriage as far as buying an automobile, rent, housing, this sort of thing. So there is a lot of emotional overlay in just the terms. I think you have to be careful. Then it's, on this specific bill, as we discussed previously, there is some question on who and how. Certainly our educational system at the higher level has not produced family life educators. The teaching curriculum as such, even as far as sex education is concerned, consists of, you can correct me if I'm wrong, some 3 hours during the 4 years. So you find that the majority of teachers, either from themselves personally, their own hang-ups, or certainly in training, are not prepared for this kind of thing. Now, realistically, however, if anybody looks at the things like Mr. Cox has seen as documented, we set up church, home, and schools as the three primary areas. You look at our divorce statistics, and very rapidly, about 50% of the children don't have a solid home base. We know from numerous statistics that about 40%. of the children under the age of 12 have never been inside a church or Sunday school. So that leaves the only other area, unfortunate as it is the school system. But it still has to be a prepared school system. Not only that, but then that doesn't mean you don't, or that you deny the importance of the home and the church. But being practical, it has to be an amalgamation of the three in some manner to approach this. It, in a way, bothers me personally a little bit on the bill is approach to another symptom.
We have the abortion bill, and we have the drug abuse bill. We have this bill that just came up, this punitive one on the 1089. And if you really look at it, basically, all these are like the tentacles of an octopus. Everybody's grabbing hold of a tentacle, and it's just rather emotional because they're hitting people where they live. And so we have another bill, and then we set up another commission. I was on the one at the state level as an alternate on the Sex Education Commission or study group or whatever through Mr. Parnell, Dr. Parnell. So you have commissions studying commissions, and each one of them grabbing a symptom. And I would hope that a council like this, maybe it shouldn't be called this, but I think it would get at what Mr. Cox is saying, much more in depth if it would be a council, maybe do away with your others on abortions and on all the symptoms, the drug abuse and so on, and have a real commission on whatever you want to call it, society's ills or some appropriate term, but deal with the disease rather than the symptoms. And I think maybe this is the beginning that has been referred to both by both the previous people. Then we're starting to get something, but there has to be a beginning. If you don't start, and it's got to be at the state level, and I think through the legislature. Because I don't think you can assign this to any one judicial area or educational area or whatever. And this commission should be, or council or whatever it is, should be a broad one, and it should be a dedicated one. And I'm sure that there are these people present in the state, like Mr. Cox and some of the others. They're dedicated and willing to spend time, effort, to start looking at the disease rather than the symptoms. And this is sort of my feeling.
Doctor, I think the only comment I would make, I have a hunch that you and I could sit down in the afternoon and decide what the disease is. The problem is how do we attack it?
This is what I would hope.
What's the medicine or the surgery or whatever? A general run of society has got a problem. A commission is going to study, and it's going to come up with some facts after 2 years that you probably not agree with.
I'm not sure.
Unless we,
I wish I were that sure.
Some way to get some action.
I wish I were that certain that we, each one of us in our own little bailiwick. I mean, I'm prejudiced because I sit there in the office all day and I, time after time, see the young, illegitimately pregnant girl or the one with venereal disease. And the thing that disturbs me more in this area than anything else over the years is the tremendous change I've seen in attitude. It's an attitudinal thing. This bland indifference sometimes that you see now with the young people toward these kind of things, the lack of consciousness of consequences, not only to themselves, but to those around them. And I think it would take more than you and I and our experiences to come up with.
Well, but
at the beginning,
we can come up with it. Problem of the disease. What occurs to me is that what I consider the problem is that you're not going to cure by any legislation.
No.
Because they're people. They're moral law problems. The moral law of man that we are either disagreeing with and or breaking for whatever reason. And no legislation is going to cure any activity if the people so choose to do it.
That's right, and it almost comes to the point of a religious crusade and a dedication to trying to get down to the very basics of human beings. I had little to do at a very short time in teaching a course at Oregon State on community reality, and this is a graduate course, and it amazed me how few people at that level in our educational system were unaware of the realities of the community. Simply how a judicial system worked and how politics worked and this type of thing.
So I think that it's it goes much deeper than the educational committee, but I would say a beginning of, you want to call it a think tank session of a group of dedicated people, let them wrestle with it. At least it's a start.
Thank you. No one else signed up to testify. House Bill 1140, so we'll close that hearing. That's it. Any further to come before the committee?
That's it.
We're adjourned.